This is the podcast of Theophilus Church. For more information, visit our website at theophiluschurch.com.
Today's reading comes out of Luke 6. It's going to be Luke 6, 27 through 38. But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn to them the other also. If someone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt from them. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is it to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is it to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those to whom you expect repayment, what credit is it to you? Even sinners lend to sinners, expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great. And you will be children of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. So we have another gift tonight. You know, pastorally, I've pastored at this church for 7 years now. And something that consistently happens in my time sitting around coffee tables with you and getting to know many of you is I walk away feeling richer, feeling more blessed, feeling like the Spirit had been imparted on me through my time spent with you. Tom and Desiree Ritz have been a part of our community for a really long time, like years and years and years. Desiree was a pastor prior to coming to Theophilus. She pastored here in Portland. Now she runs a daycare, and she serves on our council here at the church and has just been a blessing beyond measure to our community. Desiree, to me, exemplifies like the true heart of a pastor. The fruit of the Spirit lives within her and wells up and overflows out of her. It is a travesty that we haven't had the opportunity to hear from Desiree more. But tonight is one of those opportunities that we get to hear from her. And I cannot think of someone better to preach out of this passage. So please join me in welcoming Desiree Ritz.
Hey, church. It's really good to be with you tonight in this capacity. Man, if we could have just kept worshiping all night long, we would have just, I mean, we were like hitting on all the bullet points. His glory and his freedom, it's available to us, and it's thick and it's rich. And that's what we'll be talking tonight about, is how to enter into that and how to open ourselves up to that. Luke 6, what Cameron just read, it's all about this call to discipleship. To set the scene, Jesus is fresh in his ministry. He has just called his 12 disciples, and he's still hanging around the Sea of Galilee, which we've been talking about for the last, well, since we started talking about Luke, right? So he's hanging out in the Sea of Galilee, and last week we heard the first part of the sermon. It's called the Sermon on the Plain. Now, in Matthew, when Jesus does a similar sermon, it starts with the Beatitudes, just like last week. But that sermon is called the Sermon on the Mount. And the different kind of verbiage there is caused by the geographical details that both of the passages allow. In Matthew, it says that Jesus went up to a mountain and began to preach, thus the Sermon on the Mount. Where in Luke, it says that he came down to a level place. And as you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're all summarizing Jesus's life, right, through their own point of view. So Luke and Matthew have this different interpretation of this sermon, and scholars think it could be because of two reasons. One would be that Jesus taught this on multiple occasions. If you listen to what Cameron said, this is not a light and easy passage. Chances are that Jesus had to preach this multiple times so his disciples could actually let it sink in. They probably had lots of questions about this, implications of it. And so that's one option. Jesus taught this on the mountain. He taught it on the plain. He taught it probably multiple other times. Another reason of like kind of the discrepancy there and the overlap is possibly Jesus was on a level place on a mountain. If you've done your fair share of hiking or spent time even like looking near a mountain, it's not an oxymoron to say that you could be on a level place on a mountain. In fact, we could even just think about our sweet little mountain, Mount Tabor, right here in Portland. You can picture yourself near one of the reservoirs, right? That's a mountain. It's tiny, but it's actually not a whole lot bigger than one of the mountains that's near the Sea of Galilee, which is where Jesus could have been preaching this. And it's kind of cool for me to think of Jesus at our Mount Tabor in Portland. And I picture it happening in the middle of the summer. Everyone's out, right? The sun's out. Portland wakes up, comes out. People are walking their dogs. People are falling in love. They're soaking up the nature. They're hanging out on Mount Tabor. And all of a sudden, there's this like hippie in rags hanging out near the reservoir, and a crowd comes near him. And this crowd is really interested in him because he starts healing people. Like really crazy healings, like demonic healings are happening. People with demonic spirits are being cast out. So people are coming. So imagine yourself, it's a Tuesday, it's 2:00 in the afternoon, you, your friends, your colleagues, start coming to Mount Tabor because you're like hearing stuff happening on Twitter. You're hearing stuff happening on Facebook. And this huge crowd is flocking to him. And anyone who has the guts to walk up to this stranger, this new prophet in town, and touch them is being healed. Imagine your friends being healed of depression, insomnia, MS, epilepsy. These things that you've maybe been like going to a naturopath for years with no results. And this new guy in town just heals you. So this is the crowd we're talking about. These people have just been healed. And they're wanting to stick around. And they're trying to figure out, where is this power coming from? They want to know, who is this guy? And I'm sure the crowds were wise enough to make kind of this like sort of amphitheater, right, around Jesus. They positioned themselves so they could hear Jesus' voice as it was being carried in the wind. They were just eating up every word in utter amazement and with such confusion. The confusion comes in because these people, this crowd, they're waiting for this Messiah to come, and they're thinking this guy that's healing them could be the Messiah. But instead of saying, hey, let's overturn Rome and right all of your wrongs, he like does the passage that Cameron just did. He says, someone punches you? Okay, turn the other cheek. Someone steals from you? Give them your shirt also. This is confusing. This is not what they're ready for. And frankly, today, like this is still a really, really hard passage when you actually apply it to your life. As Cameron pointed out a couple weeks ago, the people of Israel, they had this prophecy that they're waiting to be fulfilled. And they weren't fixated on the future like we are. Our culture is very fixated on the future, moving forward. But instead, they were looking to the past, to their ancestors, and to prophecy. So to use Cameron's verbiage, they were facing the back of the train, allowing future to wash over them. That's how they were viewing the future, was through the past, this lens of the past. And so they're waiting for this Messiah, and he's not suggesting that they turn over the government. They're dumbfounded. As I said at the beginning, Luke 6, it's all about how to become a true disciple. He's speaking to his 12 disciples, the new ones that he just called. But here he's also speaking to the crowd that just got healed and is sticking around to see what's in store. He's offering them this ability to know how to really follow him. Are you interested in my miracles? Here. If you want to belong to the kingdom that heals, this is the lifestyle I am asking of you in order to be restored to wholeness and to offer wholeness to others. Because, church, being healed and being whole are not synonymous. Being healed and being whole, it's not synonymous. The call to discipleship is a call to wholeness. This passage is not how to become a disciple. It's about being a disciple. So how to act like one once you are one. In this passage, Jesus gives us four commands to define discipleship. First, he says love. And we all know this is the greatest commandment, right? Love God and love others as yourself. But how? Secondly, he says, do good. Thirdly, bless. Fourth, pray. And then he adds on to this command throughout the rest of the passages about lending, which is really interesting because in Jewish culture, it was acceptable to charge interest to your enemies. You lended to your brothers, but you charged to people who are outside of your inner circle. Jesus says, stop. Treat your enemies like your brothers. And Jesus goes on and he gives examples of how to do these things. And all the examples are about incredible generosity. They're examples of people going above and beyond what's expected of them, even what's expected of the holy Jewish law. You may already know who your enemies are. And if you don't now, you will. Jesus defines our enemies for us. He says, those who hate you, those who curse you, and those who abuse you. And to those people, we are called to extend generosity. When you do this, there are consequences. And when we offer up ourselves to others, there's often loss. The four implications of Jesus' calling kind of matches up with what the examples that he gave of what you do. In verse 29, it starts with the loss of your personhood, your dignity, your worth, your value. Do you think getting slapped is more disgraceful than getting punched? I asked someone today and they said, yeah, most definitely getting slapped is way more disgraceful. I think Jesus chose that word really carefully. He's talking about allowing someone to take away your dignity. Later on in verse 29, it talks about the loss of personal privileges. Not everyone has the means to have a shirt and a coat, back then and today, right? A tunic and a cloak. Jesus says, lay down all of your privileges, the things that you were born with, and even the privileges that you've worked your whole life to earn. Lay those down. If someone takes your coat, you also give them your inner garment. Then in verse 30, it goes on, and it's talking about the loss of personal power. He says, give to everyone who begs of you. That's hard for me. You don't get to decide who's in and who's out. You don't get to choose your friends just from the crowd that you want to associate with. The people that irritate you, those that you disagree with, even those people with the really repulsive views, he says, give to them. And fourthly, the last implication is the loss of personal possessions or property. The other day, someone got into our backyard, and they stole Tom's hatchet near our woodshed, and they stole a pair of his work boots from our front porch, or from our side porch. And if you've been to our backyard, that means they were wandering around our yard for a while to find those things, which just makes you feel icky, right? That someone was just hanging out in your backyard for a while, seeing what they could scavenge up. My first thought when this happened was, well, maybe whoever stole those things need them more than we do. And then I thought, no, Tom actually really needs those boots. They're his work boots. And we don't have the means to like just go out and buy them again. It's going to take us months to save up. And I'm not saying that Jesus condones theft by any means, but it really got me thinking, how readily do we offer up our materials that we know we're not going to get back? Many of us work really hard for our things. The things that we own, we're incredibly conscious of how we buy them, when we buy them, with what means we buy them for. This whole first part of this passage, Jesus' sermon, he's saying that we're not called to keep the enemy the enemy. We're not called to keep the enemy the enemy. We're called to love the enemy. And what happens when you love your enemy? That's up to them, right? That's out of our hands, but we're called to love. And how? You do good, you bless, you pray, and you lend. You show the enemy what the kingdom of God looks like, and you welcome them in. What if, when people cause us pain, instead of wishing them pain in return, we were wishing them healing and wholeness? And what if we were actually a part of the healing process? So the first part of the sermon on the plane, it's all about loving your enemies and how to go about loving your enemies. And the second part, the next portion of the sermon, Jesus is talking about judging and forgiving others. And if you just heard my throat do this thing, it's because personally, that's the part of this passage that I've had to be working on since I knew that I was prepping for this. Which is good, because I had like a month and a half to learn how to forgive someone. It's a really short section compared to some other sermons that Jesus has given when it comes to just the judging and forgiving part. It's incredibly straightforward. It's nothing I haven't heard before. And in fact, the whole sermon is such a core part of Christianity that many of us aren't hearing anything new at all. But isn't that the joy of the gospel? We know it. We know it in our heads. We know it in our hearts. Some of us actually know it in our hands and live it out. But that doesn't mean that you won't hear the same call from Jesus in a new season and have it completely flip you upside down. Because life keeps happening. We keep living. We face new adventures, new decisions, new endeavors, different difficulties you've never experienced before. And then we need to be reminded of an old truth. And for me, the act of forgiveness was this old truth that I needed to be brought back up again. When I was a little girl, one year at family reunion, one of my cousins, she was a couple years younger than me, she slapped me right across the face. Right there while we were getting ready to play mini golf. She didn't punch me out of anger. We weren't arguing. I honestly have no idea why she slapped me, and I remember being completely dumbfounded and humiliated because other people saw it. And I had never been slapped before, so I was astonished with the pain, you know, that was across my face. And every year going back to family reunion, it would bring back this memory, this really ugly, really humiliating memory. And I started to really hate my cousin. And I let it build with each passing year, because I only saw her once a year. And one year, years after the incident, I was old enough to not still be dealing with this, but I was still dealing with it. I said something probably pretty sassy to my brother about my cousin. And my brother, being the awesome guy he is, with zero tolerance, looked at me and he says, "You really need to get over that." And I remember feeling so flabbergasted, like, I should get over it? She should apologize. She should befriend me. She should be kinder. Why do I have to do anything? She should fix her problems. She's the one that slapped me. I felt like I had every right to still be angry, and I had every right to remain right, because I was right in the situation. He just rolled his eyes again and said, "Des, you really need to get over it." And I honestly didn't even know that was an option. Can I just get over a sort of assault like that? And that's an old memory, and I know, honestly, years after working through it, that I've forgiven my cousin. But reflecting on forgiveness and how I've dealt with it over the years, it brought up to surface a very current situation, a very real, very deep hurt that I needed to deal with. And it had also been going on for years. And as I've become more self-aware since the face slap, I'm learning that my brother and I's reaction to the situation has a lot to do with our temperament. Who here has taken the Enneagram test and is kind of getting obsessed with it? Yeah. Okay, so I'm a type 1. So if you know anything about type 1s or Enneagram, I naturally have to work on not judging. It's kind of a natural tendency that I have. Here's a little excerpt to describe a type 1. In brief, ones want to be right, to strive higher and improve everything, to be consistent with their ideals, to justify themselves, and to be beyond criticism so that to be not condemned by anyone. Ones do not want to be proven wrong or to make mistakes. And it goes on and on and on. In short, getting slapped in the face was like a core assault to my personhood. I'm sure it would be to many of us. Some of you hear that description of a type 1 and you go, "Oh my gosh, types 1 need to chill out. That's my brother." Or maybe you hear it and your like heart is racing a little bit and your face is turning red because you hear yourself in that. That's a part of you being described. Can any of you resonate with holding on to judgment or anger, frankly, because it just feels good to feel sometimes, even if it's a really ugly feeling? I met a man the other day when I was prepping for my sermon, and we got into this super awesome conversation. Side note, his name is Wesley. That's my son's name. And so we were talking about the text, and he pointed out to me that he has seen so much brokenness occur in his own family because everyone feels that they're right. It feels so satisfying to be right. And we often let it go too far, even to the point of our rightness being the root of our brokenness. My story of being a child getting slapped by my feisty cousin, it parallels with Jesus' call to turn the other cheek, right? He literally says, if someone slaps you on the cheek, turn the other one also. I did not do that. I defended myself. I probably, I don't know, said something sassy and ran away. I probably just ran away. This could be a troubling passage for some of us. What is Jesus actually asking us to do here? Here's a modern day example. Okay, you're on social media and someone starts to troll you. Now, my husband helped me with this analogy because I have no idea what it means to troll someone. So he explained it to me. So you're on social media and act as if you posted something, and then someone pops up in your comment section and starts to bait a reaction out of you. They try and work you up, harass you, start questioning you, to catch you off guard, set you up on a hook. Maybe it's someone from high school you haven't seen in decades, and they just like do this to people on Facebook. They're looking for a reaction. I asked him, "Sorry, trolling? Like a troll under a bridge?" He was like, no. Okay, so evidently the term trolling comes from fishing. You're on a boat, you cast out your line, and your boat is slowly moving. And as it happens, your lure is slowly moving along, trying to bait a fish. Now, what's at the end of your fishing line? Bait. But the fish doesn't know that. They think it's real. They react to something that looks promising, and they get caught. They got trolled. This can happen to us really easily, right? We get baited by someone's comments, and instead of responding with grace and generosity and, dare I say, respect, we react with defensiveness and anger. We defend ourselves. Jesus' call is not to retaliate. He's asking us to start to end a cycle of hostility. Now, for some of us, we could hear this call to offer up the other cheek after getting slapped, and it hits way too close to home, because some of you have been in or are in an abusive relationship. And let me be clear, Jesus is not asking you to remain in an abusive relationship. He is not saying, if you have been victimized, please stay because you're in charge of bringing that person to Jesus. Jesus calls us sons and daughters. He calls us conquerors. He calls us whole and redeemed. And what you're in charge of as his disciple is your soul and your call for discipleship, not anyone else's. That anger, that hurt, that humiliation, the loss of value, the loss of worth, you can lay all of that at Jesus' feet, and you couldn't find a safer place for it. Forgiveness doesn't even mean that you need to stay in the relationship or be a part of a person's redemption. The heart of forgiveness is dealing with your own personal soul. If you step back and you look at them, this person who's abused you, who's hurt you, are you able to wish that person well? Can you wish them healing and wholeness? Can you pray for them and pray blessing upon them? That anger and that hate, it'll affect your soul. And Jesus, instead, he wants you to experience freedom from that. As a disciple, he calls you to something so much greater than being controlled by your anger and your hate and your fear. He's asking you to step away from that and step into joy and glory and freedom. I'm going to read to you a section from this book called I Will Lift Up My Eyes. It's by this modern-day mystic. His name's Glenn Clark. Close your eyes. Supposing there's an old root, greed, lust, jealousy, or hate, and it seems so ingrained in your very bone, in your very nervous system, in your very blood, that there's no way of getting it out. Then, lean back and let the Christ work the miracle. When you recover from an illness, is it because you did anything? No. All you did was lie there on the bed and rest. And the cleansing blood continuously flowing through your veins brings the healing. Open your heart with absolute trust that the purest and most precious blood in all of history brings you complete cleansing and healing. Open your soul to the love of Christ, the acme of all spiritual love, the love which has the power to save and redeem the most hopeless of sinners. You can open your eyes. Are you in a cycle? Is there a deep, ugly root in your heart that you need to lay before the throne of Christ? Jesus doesn't want to just heal you like he healed the crowd that surrounded him and touched him that day. He wants to make you whole. Remember, the call to discipleship is the call to wholeness. And guess what, church? The whole of our church community is in no small way dependent on each of our individual health. The health of Theophilus is dependent on you dealing with your stuff. And the health of Theophilus is dependent on me dealing with my stuff. What would happen if we actually repent, forgive, we actually let go of anger? You can get used to anything if you have enough time, including brokenness. Maybe it's been so long that you feel that it's a part of who you are, and losing a part of who you are is really scary. It might disrupt the lifestyle you've been living. It might get in the way of your cynicism. Maybe it means saying that you're not right. Or maybe you're not quite sure that this unconditional love that Jesus is talking about, this opportunity to be the son of the Most High, is for you. sure, it's for someone else. It's for that person that just popped in your head. You know it's for them, but it couldn't possibly be for you. Do you find yourself wanting to sit back and applaud and watch glory happen versus actually jumping in and wading in its thick, glorious waters? There's glory waiting for you. There's joy that can replace your anger. Personally, when I finally learned how to forgive, I felt joy enter into my being when I was around that person. The anger, the cynicism, it didn't start ruling my every thought, my every interaction with them. And I felt more like myself the next time I was with them. I was becoming more whole. I was becoming more of a reflection of Christ. One commentary says this: it's one thing to love a friend or a stranger or the anonymous mass of humanity, but it's a completely different thing to love and forgive an enemy who hurts us and hates us. Such love will transform our world. But G.K. Chesterton has said, the trouble is that this kind of Christianity has never been tried. Man, if he's right, like, what are we doing, church? What if we were brave enough to be a part of a Christianity that actually could save the world? This call to discipleship, this call to wholeness, it's a call to live this wildly generous life, a life that does not compute with others. In this sermon, Jesus is explaining how to be a disciple of Christ. The main characteristic feature of the society of his followers must be generosity. They must be known among men to be givers rather than judges, forgiveness rather than blame. What are you known as? Are you someone that your coworkers would come to seeking generosity and grace? Or are you someone that they would kind of skirt around because of your known or maybe silent judgment? In the passage, Jesus said the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Do you want to be treated like an enemy? No? Then Jesus says, love them. But Jesus says, let me be clear. We do not love in order to receive. We are not looking for something from them in return. Jesus calls us to love without a guaranteed return, because biblical love is not dependent on behavior of the other person. God's love is not dependent on our behavior, and thank God for that. So as God loves, so should we, when people don't deserve it, full of mercy, full of grace. And by doing these things, we're demonstrating that we're born of God. We're his sons, we're his daughters. Just as he said in verse 35, we could be the sons of the Most High. That song towards the end of worship that Megan just spontaneously started singing, it's from this passage. It's about what happens when you actually lead this call to discipleship. And I'm going to read this last verse, verse 38, in a different translation. It's really beautiful. Give generously, and generous gifts will be given back to you, shaken down and made room for more. Abundant gifts will pour out upon you with such an overflowing measure that it will run over the top. Your measure of generosity becomes the measure of your return. And that return, that's from Christ. That's a heavenly reward. That's far better than anything that a person could give you. Your reward is waiting for you. And I mean, we saw it tonight. Like, it's here, right? It's entering in. Heaven is on earth. We just have to enter into it. That's what he's calling us into, church. And the thing that's really unique to Christianity is that our call to holiness and goodness, it's really intense. It's a really big call. And frankly, it's impossible. But we're called by Jesus to live this lifestyle, and we're not left to our own devices. I frankly, unknowingly, was trying to forgive on my own for years. I thought that I was connecting with Christ when I was forgiving, but I wasn't, because I'm a one, so I was doing it on my own. I'm super independent. And it didn't work. My anger kept rising up. My cynicism was just always there. It's impossible to forgive on our own. It's literally outside of our human nature. Our human nature is to defend. It's to protect yourself. And church, we've been given the Holy Spirit. We've been given this power that's supernatural. It's outside of us. You might have heard this story before. It's a story of forgiveness that hardly any of us could comprehend. This command to pray for and to forgive those who abuse you, it's right in line with Corrie Ten Boom's story about meeting a Nazi SS guard who stand at the shower room door in the processing center at a German concentration camp where her and her sister was imprisoned in World War II. When she recognized him at a church service, she could not bring herself to shake his hand until she breathed a silent prayer. Jesus, I cannot forgive him. Give me your forgiveness. And when I read that, a couple months ago now, it completely reworked how I thought about forgiveness. I can't do it. We can't. We don't have the power to do it. And so we asked Jesus, can we have your forgiveness, please? Because I don't have enough. As we're ending tonight and transitioning into communion, I want us to take a moment, and we're going to name one person that's abused you, that's hurt you, that's cursed you, and you ask Jesus for his forgiveness for that person. If you need to, when you come down to the altar, seek his face and stay and linger. There is no rush. We can seek this forgiveness because Jesus is offering it to us, because he wants you to take up the call to discipleship. He doesn't make it impossible. He sends you the Spirit who makes all of these things possible. He gives us this supernatural power. We're following a God that enables us to say, Father, I cannot forgive. Give me your forgiveness. This is what makes the call to discipleship possible. So if you're serving communion tonight, please come down. Church, this space, this is for you. This space in the pews, this is for you. Stay, worship, pray, learn how to bless those who curse you. Try and act this out and start it tonight. Let him flip your life upside down. Let him remind you of this old truth that you've known to forgive. You've known to not let judgment rule you. We've been told to live generously. Stick around for a while and really think about it. How is this going to change your life? So our communion folks are here. There's also communion in the back, and there's gluten-free elements in all of the stations. Everyone's welcome. You don't have to get your stuff together before you come. Jesus is asking to come with your mess, and he'll meet you here.
You've been listening to the podcast of Theophilus Church. We hope you've been inspired and challenged by what you've heard. For more information, visit our website at TheophilusChurch.com.